Good Monday morning. Welcome back to In Focus here on News Radio KMAN. Brady Bowman with you, here with Dr. Timothy Schaefer. He's the Assistant Professor of Communication Studies at K-State and the Assistant Director of the K-State Institute for Civil Discourse and Democracy. And again, we teased it a little bit in the first segment, but we're going to talk about the millennial generation. And I'm sure a lot of ears probably in folks' cars probably perked up a little bit. That's right. America's punching bag. We're going to look at them for a little bit and really focus on this article that came out by Axios that came out, July 22nd. So pretty recent. And basically, it looks at being 30 then and now. And it really looks at 1977 compared to 2016. And it looks at how life has changed for Americans aged 25 to 34. And I'm towards the tail end of that. I'm 32. And it breaks down a lot of different things here right from the beginning. It looks at the cost of four-year college. And again, these numbers are adjusted for inflation. So cost of public four-year college, 1977, $8,000. 2016, $20,000. Median debt, 1977 for this age group was $10,000. Now it's $33,000. Never married. This is an interesting stat here. 20% was never married in 1977. Now it's 53% for, again, the ages 25 to 34. Attending more than 4 years of college. That was 24%. Now it's 37%. But I think the big statistic, Tim, that's really stuck out to a lot of people, because I've seen this shared on social media quite a bit since this article came out, was that median income has stayed flat since 1977, adjusted for inflation, still at $34,000 for Americans aged 25 to 34. It was, again, adjusted for inflation, it's also $34,000 in 1977, so it's remained flat. So you look at that flat median income, yet debt has increased from $10,000 to $33,000. Costs of college has went up from $8,000 to $20,000, but incomes are flat. And we ask ourselves, you see these headlines of millennials aren't buying diamonds, they're not getting married, they're not having kids, they're not buying houses. Well, there's a reason for that.
Yeah, there are some challenges. I mean, one important thing I think to note, especially when, you know, using the term millennial, that depending on, there are a couple age ranges, but typically if you're born in the early 80s and on, you would be considered a millennial. So there are millennials, and I fall within this camp, on the old camp, on the older end of that, right? Shy of 40, you know, the mid-30s upwards, that you're still considered, quote, a millennial. So I think the use of that term just to denote a really young person is not necessarily that helpful. It's the same way that I still think of things from the early 2000s as being fairly recent, and then every once in a while I have that realization that was, 15 plus years ago, or, you know, the late 90s, not feeling that long ago. It always catches me when I'm traveling in the airport and I'll see CNN now doing the, the decades, right? And
they're doing the 2000s.
They're doing the 2000s.
Which is weird.
I'm like, oh my gosh.
I'm not ready for that.
Yeah, it's, you know, and it's a reality. So I think there's something helpful, especially when we start talking about some of the intergenerational dynamics, that the perception of, you know, quote, the kids these days, it's not necessarily just, you know, the kids. It's people who are squarely in the workforce or are kind of moving up through ranks and employment, things like that, who are categorically millennials.
And it's, again, going back to some of those economic things that we just looked at, looking at this article from Axios, and, you know, it says today 30-year-old millennials are more likely to be still living with their parents, and while earning about the same or less than baby boomers, are, of course, typically saddled with college debt. Of course, one consequence it points out is that possible trouble for an older generation. And I really like this, because this is something I don't think people really think about or talk about. But on this article, one consequence of some of these numbers that we described and just some of these situations that we described is that the possible trouble is for the older generation that will rely on the younger generation doing better. And when you really think about that, that makes a lot of sense, because younger generations are needed to take care of the older generations.
Well, yeah, right. I mean, we could talk about that from the economic standpoint, also talking about just, you know, having children, you know, all these factors. The we're seeing this globally, too. Places like Japan are struggling to figure out, like, how do we attend to an aging population when younger generations aren't you know, kind of stepping into what are otherwise the assumed or kind of expected roles, right? You'll buy the house, you'll have the family, you'll kind of fulfill your role societally and then also economically, right? In kind of the capitalist model, that's how this works. And so when there are some glitches or hangups to some of that, then it starts to throw off not just the young person who might still be living in their parents', you know, what used to be their room is now technically a guest room, but, you know, the larger societal impacts are then felt. I mean, and then from the standpoint of a lot of the work that that I do and others is, you know, how do you invite or engage people in, say, community conversations about, you know, public issues if you're trying to work through jobs or if you're trying to, I mean, we can talk across the board, millennials and otherwise, but, like, you know, there are some serious ramifications from this kind of stagnation, truly.
That's a very good point, because it's hard to participate in democracy if you don't have time to, right? Yeah, I mean, it makes things extremely difficult. And I just know, thinking about, you know, my grandparents are getting older and older. I still have two left on my mom's side. And honestly, just even just my parents, I'm starting to realize they're getting older. And I know that I had a great-grandma that passed away 2 years ago, and I remember hearing about the expense of all that when she was in a lack for a better word, old folks home, mm-hmm. towards the end. I think a hospice at the mm-hmm. towards the end, was maybe that last year, and just kind of hearing about just the expense of that, like just per month at those sort of places, it's astounding how much it cost. And you just think about that, and I just think about that for myself. It's like, well, you know, I hope that I'm in a position when it gets to that point that my parents are older and I need to be the one and my sister needs to be the people to take care of them. Are we going to be able to? I hope so. I'm just trying to take care of myself right now. And that's a struggle. You know, I think that's something that my generation has a very unique sort of challenge compared to previous ones, is that when it comes to being in that position later in life, I hope I'm in a position financially that I can take care of them. But right now, I don't know.
Yeah.
I don't know.
No, these are, I mean, the intergenerational question, I mean, this is huge when we start to think about, you know, where do you stand individually and then also, you know, collectively, you know, how do we kind of, you know, attend to those generational populational shifts? I mean, particularly a colleague of mine at K-State, he studies demography and, you know, population changes, and talking about, you know, some of these really rural communities across the state that are just, you know, basically going back to qualifying as frontier again, right? Because of the population density and the drops. And
actually,
and
called frontier, but
yeah,
that's like the actual designation.
Yeah, categorically through the federal government, how they classify some of these places. And we saw it in the news quite a bit in recent years about hospital consolidations across Kansas and rural health access, all sorts of things. These all come into play when we start to think about you know, the work that we do. You know, how do you get people involved in kind of and shared life and public life? But when there aren't these resources, one of the major initiatives that comes out of K-State is very close colleagues of mine who work with the Institute, the Rural Grocery Initiative. They just had a big annual conference for people from all over the country. But, you know, basically looking at, you know, what are the implications when small towns lose their local grocery store, which is not only a place to buy some food and, you know, milk and eggs, but also a convening location for conversations, people to be in the loop of what's going on. So when we start to think about the implications back to that Axios report of, you know, who's buying homes or who's not, right? Where are people living? And as we're seeing population trends shifting to urban rather than rural places, what does that mean for a state like Kansas when the urban centers, the metro areas are growing, but a lot of the rural places are very challenged. And looking around and saying, you know, where are the younger people? And when it comes down to, you know, some of these realities of the not only the what's your income, but like what are the economic opportunities that exist in lots of places. You know, the world has changed. We're seeing it playing out right now with all of the conversation about global trade, right? I mean, where are these things going? And revealing, I think, to some people, especially, you know, for folks like for myself, I'll just use me as an example, hearing a lot of these accounts of farmers across Kansas, places in Nebraska, Iowa, elsewhere, the reality of where their products are going, right? It's not a simple world. And seeing the interplay of a lot of those pieces, it then speaks back to the reality of what does it mean to live in these places, to think of, you know, the local co-op sending virtually everything that's produced elsewhere, you know, not to be consumed in the United States, those kinds of things. Those are different realities and with implications for communities, right? I mean, the number, we were talking about the county fair earlier, but, you know, looking over the decades, there were some images in one of the buildings of every generation of how much a farmer had to work to produce certain bushels of you know, wheat or whatever else it might be. And the, you know, the number now is always, what, 155 people plus you that a farmer feeds. Well, part of that is just because of scale and possibility. And other implications are that, you know, there aren't that many people that live in these little communities because you don't need them to. There's not that same kind of vibrant life. And so there are, you know, beyond the kind of nostalgic, like, oh, gosh, wouldn't it be nice if there were still these little mom and pop shops and the smaller local communities. The realities, the economic realities, which is often what drives most of this, is that doesn't really work very well. And so there are some efforts like the RGI, the Rural Grocery Initiative, that really speak to what are the larger implications for communities. But it has huge amounts to do with, you know, kids when they go off to college, do they come back or not? Right, and often they don't. I'm the product of that. I'm somebody, I left my hometown when I went to college, and I've never returned in any kind of stable way, right, and to live there. And so that's significant for a lot of places around the country as we think about not only economic opportunities, but also the kind of social, political, cultural implications of that.
It gets more complicated when you get the whole reality thing in there, yeah. Right? Because in today's political climate, we're really not even talking about reality anymore in any respect when we're talking about political discourse. And I'm sure that's a challenge in what you deal with all the time with your job and scope, is just trying to get back to the reality of it and getting away from all the rhetoric that is just that. It's not based in reality whatsoever. And when you look at some of these numbers, when you are looking at reality, it does just change the scope on everything. And it really throws out all the political party rhetoric out the window, because you look at this one statistic on this Axios report, and I think you kind of touched on it a little bit ago, but just on home ownership for millennials compared 1977 to 2016, 1977, 48% of those in that millennial age bracket own homes. Now it's 39%. So almost a 9-point drop there. And when you think about the economic reality of that, of having less people own homes, that's an even continuously shrinking tax base. And then that's where it goes into how city governments are funded, how local governments are funded.
Yeah.
Does rent go up to make up for that? How do people live if is everybody renting? Is everybody just in apartment complexes? You know, that going back to what you're talking about of like when you boil stuff down to the reality of things in the world we live in, it's a different vision than what we see in kind of the mess of cable news and now Twitter. Yeah, you know, it's just all over the place.
Yeah, no, I mean, there are some, there was a book two summers ago that I was reading called The Vanishing Neighbor, and it built off of work of others like Robert Putnam and Bill Bishop, who talked about, you know, the impact of these shifts, right? But in this book called The Vanishing Neighbor, it uses this little anecdote at the beginning, and it basically asks you, think of the people, your neighbors, when you were growing up. Can you still name them? And then think about your neighbors now, right? Depending on where you live, if it's in a house or an apartment complex, whatever it might be. And it's usually a lot easier to think of the folks where you were living and growing up. And you know, there are implications to that, right? That the home ownership thing, it's not everybody needs to necessarily own a home, especially in urban places sometimes, or in economically challenged communities, that's not a reality. But one implication is, for a lot of places, is stability, right? If you own a place, you're more likely to stick around rather than move quite as much. And so when you start to think about the fabric of a place, there are implications, right? If so-and-so has been down the street for decades, that's different than being like, oh, I don't know who that is down the street. Not that you can't meet them, but there are some things there.
And now the other thing with homeownership that's just so key to think about is that when you own a home, you also have equity. From a financial standpoint, like, it's, you have an easier time getting loans and those sort of things. You have some sort of collateral when it comes to being getting financed for whatever else in life you may need to be financed for. If you just rent, you don't have anything you can go back on to, you know, to maybe get some more financing. We do have a phone call. Go ahead, caller, on in Focus.
Yes, I have a comment. I graduated high school in 1970, and ever since then, the younger generation has been taking the nation to pot, and yet we're doing all right. So, anyway, thank you for your hard work at getting people to get along.
Yeah, taking people to pot, can you expand on that? Like, what do you mean?
Well, like, when I graduated high school, the Vietnam War was going on. And so my generation was protesting against the Vietnam War. And the older generation was more backing the Vietnam War. And we were doing drugs and having different ideas and had the sexual revolution. So all kinds of things were going on that the older generation didn't approve of. Does that make any sense?
I think I get where you're going with this. You know, I think one of the implications that we're seeing it now, and especially the ways that we talk about the millennial generation, is this intergenerational reality how do older generations look at those who are younger, right? When kind of the norms, you know, the mores, what are the things that are shifting and changing? And so, you know, there are implications that if across the board the thing that was kind of agreed upon is no longer agreed upon, there, you know, there are some reverberations from that. So we said it many ways, very generationally. So I don't know if I'd say if we're going to pot, but the fact that people do see the world and experience it differently is a significant thing.
All right, thanks so much for that call. Let's take that break. We'll come back and talk more with Dr. Timothy Schaefer. You're listening to In Focus on News Radio KMAN.